9/12, from 8:00 p.m. on Thursday, April 22nd, 2021, from the president, our representative of the school, from the second myself, representatives follows. Thanks to us, probably have any email partners in our bookings, and absolutely be available for that staff members today. We are going by teleconference, we seem to come into a special economic research, outside presentation scheduled, by mid-morning also. Also, we have some economic research, and we're hoping that we get two presentations before we wrap our time today. I apologize to our presenters, we're going to, that sometimes happens, I can hold things or. So we go ahead and I invite Dr. Patani to introduce herself and her opening proceedings presentation. We are still here, sir. And we welcome Representative Story.
Thank you for having me, my name is Steve Patani, I'm an associate professor of economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage. I'm fellow of the economics department, and I'm a student. And what I'm doing today is walking you through some of the basics from our analysis that we released in 2016. The intent of the project was to try and figure out what were the economy-wide effects and distributional effects of a few of the fiscal options that are available to the state. I'm gonna go through the slides, talk a little bit about our modeling, what we found, what we didn't find, and what kind of takeaways one can potentially draw from the study, so please feel free to interrupt. And so I'm gonna move to the second slide, and just kind of remind you that this is a study in 2016. I just wanted to note that the world has changed a little bit since then, in the sense that in 2016, it was the first year of that three-year recession that was driven by the higher oil prices. We still had quite a bit of savings in CDR, and at the time, one of the questions that we were asked is, how will closing the budget gap influence economic activity? And so just to give you a sense of what kind of questions were being raised at the time, clearly we had a three-year recession, we came out of it in 2019, we had very, very weak growth in 2019, and then we got hit with the pandemic, which has further resulted in further deterioration of economic activity. But clearly the fiscal situation has really not changed that much, except for the fact that we've exhausted savings to a large degree, and now essentially are just working with the earnings reserve. And so the reason I'm caveating is because one of the things that's obvious, that's going to become obvious, is when I talk about the fiscal options such as a tax or a cut to government taking money out of the economy, is because we are essentially comparing them indirectly to the use of savings. And right now, the use of savings is really not much of an option. Views may differ, but we don't have as much runway when it comes to savings as we did at the time. So the third slide just lists for you the conclusions from the original study. I'm just putting them up here again for context. The world has changed somewhat. But it's important to again just recognize a couple of things. The first point is something that I know all of you have been thinking about, which is that the reality is that the state has a lot of options, but clearly different ways of raising money to potentially close the budget are going to affect different groups of Alaskans differently, meaning that an income tax will fall more on higher income to raise money in any one of these ways, but there needs to be a recognition that not all options are created equal in terms of who ends up bearing the burden, if you will. And one of the reasons why the burden is unequally distributed is, again, the question of who pays. And the question of who pays depends on what's the difference between residents and non-residents, what's the difference in terms of income composition. And so I think that that's important to remember. The second bullet point is the one that I touched on earlier, which is that in our original report, if you go back to it, we mentioned quite a few times that the only option that does not cost the economy or that doesn't take money out of the economy is the use of savings. And to further explain, what we mean by that is a tax or a reduction in the GDP or a government cut all essentially takes money out of the pockets of the last things and potentially some non-residents, and therefore is going to have negative short-term effects on the economy. Even if you impose a tax, people have less money, therefore they're able to spend less money at retailers or restaurants. But when we talk about using savings or withdrawing money from the permanent fund, that does not have short-term effect because that money would just essentially be invested in stocks and bonds. That does not, however, mean that that option is costless. As you all know, and you've heard in previous presentations, there is a big opportunity cost to overdrawing money from the fund. Additionally, we know that we shouldn't put too much stress on the earnings reserve, and we know that there is uncertainty regarding growth in the fund. So I just need to make this clear because this question comes up quite a bit, but we essentially said that it's costless to withdraw money from the fund. All we were saying is any option that takes money out of the pockets of Alaskans will have negative short-term effects. That's important to consider. Taking money out of savings does not, in the short run, have negative effects. However, it does have negative consequences in the short run and the long run. So there are trade-offs. And, again, there's one last point, which is that at the time, we have, again, more runway or more savings. So the state, I guess, could afford to leave our savings potentially more than it does now. And then the last bullet point of the deficit is so big, the overall economic effects of closing the deficit will also be big. I guess it's in the eye of the beholder whether the deficit is still big or not. From where I stand, the fiscal picture has not changed, the urgency has not changed, and the deficit is still substantial. But again, these are conclusions. If you were able to rely on and look at the world from the 2016 lens, that's the conclusion we reached at the time.
Short-term and long-term impact, we believe that there isn't you were starting to talk about the impacts of spending from the permanent fund. And if we, for example, had a flat budget that we paid, for example, the governor's proposal to get back gap between statutory spending, because these are the last few years, that would result in a pretty massive drawdown from the permanent fund, which, according to my reckoning, would actually have an impact, maybe not this year, but it would have an impact as early as the year after next.
That's fair. So let me just be very, very clear. When we say short run in the analysis, and the way we get the analysis, short run is typically defined as a time period before households, businesses have the opportunity to change their behavior. So what does that mean in simpler terms? Typically, we think about a 12 to 18-month period that's defined as the short run, meaning you take money out of the economy, and then you see that reverberation of that effect. However, you're absolutely right that the world has changed, and now if you're talking about, for example, I'm making the number up, changing the calculation of next year's dividends or how much is available for borrowing. And so, again, the fact that we are still drawing from the CBR means that the short-term effects were milder and non-existent because, again, the permanent fund, aside from distributing the dividend, was not touching the Alaska economy directly. Right, and so it's a nuanced point, but I think that you raise something that's important, which is that when I say that the negative effects from overdrawing the fund are not going to manifest until the long run, that may be actually misstated in the sense that you may end up seeing some of those negative effects sooner if you stress the earnings reserve, and therefore A, affects its growth rate, and B, potentially decrease the size of the fund, which affects how much in dividends you're actually able to pay. So that's, I guess, my answer to the question for the way that will clarify your point.
All right, thank you. That represents further question. That's insignificant for the following year, and that's compounded every year because to have a fiscal gap to make that up, I see that as really significant. And so, any thoughts on that? Is that what you believe we are losing in these trainings? And your comments on that, please.
Through the chair represents the story. I think that the $50 million is basically a simple way of thinking about it, and that you're saying you're foregoing somewhere close to 5% in earnings by withdrawing additional dollars. I think there's no doubt that the trade-off exists, right? And so every dollar that we withdraw from the fund is a dollar that's not invested, is a dollar that's not earning interest, and therefore that negatively affects the long-term size of the fund, its ability to fund government, and its ability to distribute dividends. I don't think there's anybody, irrespective of how they see the world, that would debate that point. The question is, again, the trade-off exists, so how do you weigh those potential losses in the size of the fund against short-term effects, against some of these other options? And so I think that you're both raising a very clear point, which is the option of tapping the permanent fund is not costless. How much it costs exactly, I think we can go through multiple exercises by saying, look, the costs are 5% a year or 7% a year. Obviously, the fund has performed remarkably well, and its performance was very good this year. And so I think I would say, yes, every time you take more money than what's sustainable, you're foregoing future growth, you're foregoing growth in the fund. However, again, the imposition of some other form of revenue gathering also has costs. And so I think that not to punt, but there is no free lunch, there is no costless option. And I think that we have gotten to the point where I think that the conclusion from our report where we say, look, taking money from savings is going to potentially protect the economy is not as true as it was in 2016. So on slide 4, I just list essentially the options that we looked at. I need to say that these are fairly generic options. In the analysis in the report, we go through a great deal of care in explaining that our analysis is limited by data availability and by also things that we felt like we could potentially speak about with confidence given the information that we have, we start to make assumptions. We kind of looked at the options that are there more modelable, and the ones that the legislature was interested in, and there were a lot of questions about. I need to be clear that when we say, for example, cuts to government, that the very, very generic cuts that I modeled, because we did not have specific comedians. And one thing that's important to remember is that no two cuts are created equal. Meaning that if you say, oh, and I'm making this up, the legislature is no longer going to give contracts to some firm that operates out of Seattle, and then the negative effect of eliminating a contract are very different than laying off 20 workers that work in the Department of Health and Social Services in the country. And that nuance matters, right? And so that's something that we couldn't address specifically because at the time there were no proposals that were saying this is how we want to implement those cuts. Now, similarly, when we model taxes, we're essentially modeling very generic taxes, either a surcharge over the federal tax or some sort of sales tax that excludes certain categories. But what we're really hoping to get at is let's kind of see what happens to economic activity, again, in the short run, if we're to remove money from the economy in order to balance the budget through these different ways. And cutting the permanent fund dividend was also one of the options that we looked at. So if you're trying to wrap your head around what did we actually do, you can put them in a few different buckets. There was the government cut component, there was the tax component, and then there was the PFD, right? And so those are the three buckets. Clearly, you can either say, you know, they're all the same. And again, just to be clear, every single one of these options essentially allows the state to close a portion of its budget gap. What's the challenge? The challenge is that any one of these options, again, is taking money from some group of households, from some part of the economy, and therefore is putting that short-term pressure on economic activity. And I need to be clear, and I've been saying this, I've presented some variation of this a lot over the last 5 years, and I've been saying that I don't believe that the short-term effects are the only ones that need to be taken into account, right? And so, whether we talk about quality of life or whether we talk about policy uncertainty, and I'll discuss that here in a little bit, those are all things that matter, right? And so, and lingo or policy uncertainty is very costly as well, and I try to estimate how much policy uncertainty costs. And so, I don't want it to seem like we have all the answers or that this information gives you all the answers. This is analysis that basically says, assume you were to implement one of these things and you want to raise some amount of money, what can you expect the economic hit to be in the short run? And is that something we're willing to live on? Because, again, there is nothing that we can do at this stage that's just not going to have any short-term effect on the economy.
Thank you. Dr. Kabat, have a question for Vice Chair Hall.
Thank you, Dr. Chair. I just want to clarify, I think what I heard you say, and if I'm mistaken, let me know, but you said taking money from people's homes will have a negative effect. I assume you mean cutting the PFD.
Taking money out of households' pockets. So that's a cut of the PFD, that's a tax, anything that basically reduces disposable income for the amount of money that people have.
Yeah, I guess just for language sake, reducing the PFD, I personally see that taking money away from anyone, it's giving it less. And over the years, the history of the PFD, I've been here pretty much the whole life of the PFD, it goes up and down, it can be a lot more, obviously. But if I got run out one year and run out the next year, whatever that, they're taking money away. I just received less. So
the categories to my statement was not a judgment statement. I guess I'm being the economist in that I was basically talking about less money circulating in the economy, right? And so that's really what we're looking at. We are looking at, as you said, the dynamics from year to year, which means that the amount of money that circulates in the economy or that's available to people changes. And so a cut to the PFP, similar to a tax, is going to result in less money circulating in the economy. And so I think you can frame it a few different ways. What we were trying to do and what we did is essentially say, assume there is less money in year X, right? And so because people are going to receive less money. What is the consequence of having less money in the economy on economic activity if we follow it through the system? That's really all we're doing rather than thinking through. I think I understand the point you're making, but my statement was not trying to finesse it, I suppose. And I think if you do So what I'm going to do is, in order to, I think you understand the broad strokes of the analysis. And so in slide 5, really, I'm just explaining to you again, and I think that this is a follow-up on a previous question, which is really what we're doing in a very simple way, is saying, if there is less money circulating in the economy as a result of one of these taxes, whether it's an income tax or a sales tax, or a reduction in the PFP, or if we cut government, now there is less money circulating. What are the indirect and use effects of this? What does that mean? That means that there is a person, for example, has $1,000 less, they're going to spend less money on a retailer. That retailer, in turn, is going to hire fewer workers, order fewer goods and services. And see, that's the range of the analysis. So if you think about it in steps, it's A, let's estimate the revenues that a particular policy option can raise. And that depends, again, on how much federal tax, how many non-residents are affected, how many residents. So let's figure out how much revenue an option can raise. Once we figure out how much an option can raise, how much income will households have less as a result of raising that money? And then once we figure out how much less money households have, then we basically say, let's shock those households, meaning let's remove that money from households' pockets, and let's see what are the consequences, again, economy-wide, of that particular reduction in income. That's really all there is to it. And so I'm going to jump to slide 6 if there are no questions. So I think that in the interest of time, this again is further explaining what we're doing. And I think if there are no questions, I'm going to just skip it in the interest of time. Again, really just the mechanics. And I'll just say one quick thing about it. People always ask me this, is why are those government cuts, or why are the effects of government cuts big? And the reason for that is if you model the layoffs, then you're losing a job through the layoff, plus you're losing the income that's associated with the layoff, which means that you're losing the direct effect in the job loss, plus you're losing whatever jobs are lost, because that individual is no longer able to spend his or her money. And when we talk about the other options, those are all income shocks. Right? And so there is no quote-unquote direct loss of jobs in any of those other options. Because when I impose a tax, and again, taking money from households, depending on what the tax is, I am not losing any direct jobs. There are job losses that result from people spending less money, but there is no direct. participation, and in the interest of time, I'm just going to focus on the last bullet point, which is really the devil is in the details. And that's something you all know much more better than I do. But these are generic options. When there is an actual proposal, obviously we'll be happy to look at it and kind of discuss what are its effects. These are, I don't want to say proposals that we came up with, but through conversations with people that were involved in the process, we basically asked what are the options on the table and let's look at them. So the slides 8 and 9 really are the important slides, if you will, from the analysis. And these are, again, economy-wide effects. And what you see before you are two scenarios. We ended up modeling two scenarios because we used a few different data sets. We used an input-output model that follows the shocks to the economy through the system, and then we used U.S. census data in order to try and estimate these reductions in a slightly different way. So the first slide, the first of two slides I'm going to show you are, the first one is child impact. So what does that tell you? These are the job losses that are associated with $100 million increase, if you will, in a tax or in dividend reductions or in government cuts. So the way to think about it is for every $100 million of money that we raise through each one of these options, what are the short-term consequences on the economy? And again, these are job losses. And the way to kind of think about why the job losses is, again, coming back to that principle that I discussed a little while ago, which is that we're essentially removing money in the short run from circulation, if you will. And so what's the big takeaway here is, to me, there is not that big of a difference when it comes to job losses across the PFD slash tax options. The one that stands out in the government reduction, and it's simply due to what I just said earlier. It's mechanical, but it also allows you to think about if I start with a layoff, I'm losing both the job and the income associated with the job. If I start with an income reduction, then I start with an income reduction, and then I'm losing jobs along the way because there is less money circulating. But the variation in the effects stems largely from are non-residents affected, what's the federal tax, and what are the distributional effects of that particular shock? Meaning, are we taking more money from high-income households, from low-income households, from middle-income households? And so I've never been a fan of ranking the options because, again, they're fairly generic. But what to me they make obvious is there are consequences across the board. You kind of have to decide how many of these consequences you want to live with in the short run. Who do we want to pay for these things? Meaning, do we want to structure something so that non-residents bear as much of the burden as possible? Do we want to shelter lower-income households? Do we want the quote-unquote pain to be equally distributed? What's the policy solution that we think makes the most sense? And again, in the interest of time, I just want to say that the short-run effects are not overarching question, right, that most of you are grappling with, because there are potentially more pressing concerns like what happens in 5 years or in 10 years or in 2 decades, and what kind of economy or budget does Alaska have.
Dr. Gitarbi, do you want to talk about also perhaps a little bit about the characteristics of the job losses as an alternative the compensation level for job losses that would be created by the current dividend, that cut would be different than those, for example, on a state employee?
Absolutely. Thank you for that few temporary positions, but in our analysis, when we look specifically at what is the economic effect, for example, of the PFD, we find that there are, for every $100 million in the PFD, there are around 500 or 600 jobs that are created in the short run. So coming back to this, we're talking about potentially missing out on temporary jobs if you want to reduce the PFD, if you don't talk about government cuts, those are potentially permanent cuts that are higher paid jobs, and that's also reflected in some of these results. So I think it's important to again not think that a job is a job is a job. We've tried our best to think about full-time equivalent jobs, but the composition of the jobs is going to vary depending on the option, depending on again. So for example, lower-income households tend to spend more of their income on higher-income households, and so the options that are going to affect lower-income households are going to end up resulting in more job losses, but those job losses are going to end up being concentrated in, for example, retail or leisure hospitality. The average wage of a government worker is $50-some thousand. That's considerably higher than what the retail jobs that we're discussing when it comes to job loss associated with PFD.
The state has a deficit. We think that taxes, for example. So we raise tax, doesn't pay the coffers, so we spend it. So it's powered back in the economy. Is that in consideration? I think the state raises $200 million and spends it. And we could spend it, but same $600 million they could spend on PFD. So do we need one more idea with that doing less?
I think that that's a really important point to make here, which is when we're estimating these options, we're basically doing, if you will, the first step, which is impose a tax, take money from households, households have less money. But this does not have within it, because again, the assumption is the alternative is to take money out of savings, which is quote unquote costless. I'm going to air quotes here, I don't know if you can see it or not. Obviously, as we've established, is not possible. So what you're saying is really important, meaning really in order to think about long-term effects and true effects of these options, you really have to ask, assume I tax and I raise some amount of money, how will that money actually be used? Right now, obviously, as you all know, we've been filling the budget gap with savings, which means that those savings do not have or use of those savings do not have negative effects on the economy. If you decide, I'm going to tax, but I'm going to turn around and I'm going to spend it potentially in the same way that households are going to spend it, then of course it's a wash, right? And so the differences are going to emerge based on how is the money allocated, who did we take it from, what are the consequences of that shock, and how does the government end up spending it? But again, just the last point here, I know that we're running short on time, is that the comparison is always, or was always, that we had some other source of money that we were filling the budget gap with. Clearly, that's no longer the case. And that other source was the CBR and now the earnings reserve, but all of those options are essentially not taking money from the economy in the short run. So you're comparing one option that doesn't take money from the economy to one that does, and hence you get these losses. If we focus specifically on your scenario, the answer becomes slightly different, but I think is a big, great point. Slide 9 essentially asks the same question and we use exactly the same technique, but instead of looking at global losses, we look at income losses. And as you can see, the picture becomes slightly different. And the reasons for that is now the residency of workers kind of becomes a little bit more talent in that, as you know, 20% of the Alaska workforce is non-resident. And so what you're seeing here again is for $100 million of deficit reduction, what are the consequences in terms of income reductions? And here, you see that the PFP becomes the option that removes the most income from the economy. Why is that? Because it obviously falls most squarely on residents, while the other options are more distributed towards non-residents. Some of it is going to the federal government, that's also raised for the PFP. But again, I think to my eyes, the differences are really not that big across the options. It's more how do we want to structure this so that we can raise money to fill the gap and figure out which portions or which types of households or which regions of the state we are able to bear the burden.
All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your presentation and your opinions as this hour and a lot of time for good slides. And I would just please that Herb's in short beginning at 1:26 p.m. We're going to work to try to bring back Dr. Berman and hopefully Dr. DeGarby. Thank you.